Jana Valabha Giri Parada Shodanandana Raja Janaranjana Raja Janaranjana Ashodanandana Raja Janaranjana Yamunatira Yamunatiravanachari Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jayo Jayo Shri Chaitanya Jai Nityananda Jai Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Jayo Jayo Shri Chaitanya Jai Nityananda Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Jaya Jaya Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
This morning we're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya offers prasad to the Lord. And the text is 270.
Ayu Shriyam Yashodharmam
Ayu Shriyam Yashodharmam
Lokana Shishaivacha
Lokana Shishaivacha
Hanti Shreyansi Sarvani
Hanti Shreyansi Sarvani
Pumso Mahat Atikramaha Ayu Shriyam Yashodharmam
Ayu Shriyam Yashodharmam
Lokan Ashishaivacha
Lokan Ashishaivacha
Hanti Shreyansi Sarvani
Hanti Shreyansi Sarvani
Pumso Mahat Atikramaha Would anyone like to chant?
Ayushriyam Yashodharmam
Ayushriyam Yashodharmam
Lokanashisha Evacha
Lokanashisha Evacha
Antishriyamsi Sarvani
Antishriyamsi Sarvani
Umsomahadikramaha
Umsomahadikramaha
Ayushriyam Yashodharmam
Atikramaha Shisha eva cha Antishayamsi sarvani Pumso mahat atikramaha Hantishayansi sarvani Kramaha Hagati kramaha Ayushriyam yasodharmam Okanashisha evacha Sarvani
word meanings. Ayu, duration of life. Shriyam, opulence. Yashaha, reputation. Dharmam, religion. Lokan, possessions. Ashishaha, benedictions. Eva, certainly. Cha, and. Hanti, destroys. Shayansi, good fortune. Sarvani, all. Pumsaha, of a person. Mahat, of great souls. Atikramaha, violation. Translation. When a person mistreats great souls, his lifespan, opulence, reputation, religion, possessions, and good fortune are all destroyed. Purport, Srila Prabhupada. This is a statement made by Shukadev Goswami, who was relating Srimad Bhagavatam 10.4.46 to Maharaj Parikshit. This quotation concerns the attempted killing of Krishna's sister, Yogamaya, who appeared before Krishna's birth as the daughter of Mother Yashoda. This daughter, Yogamaya, and Krishna were born simultaneously, and Vasudeva replaced Krishna by taking Yogamaya away. When she was brought to Mathura, and Kamsa attempted to kill her, Yogamaya slipped out of his hands. She could not be killed. She then informed Kamsa about the birth of his enemy, Krishna, and being thus baffled, Kamsa consulted his associates, who were all demons. When this big conspiracy was taking place, this verse was spoken by Shukadev Goswami. He points out that a demon can lose everything because of his nefarious activities. The word Mahat Atikramaha, meaning envy of Lord Vishnu and his devotees, is significant in this verse. The word Mahat indicates a great personality, a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a devotee or the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. Being always engaged in the Lord's service, the devotees themselves are as great as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The word Mahat is also explained in Bhagavad Gita 9.13, Mahatmanas tumam partha daivim prakritimashitaha bhajantyananya manaso gyatva bhutadim avyayam. That is, O son of Prita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. End quote. Being envious of the Lord and his devotees is not at all auspicious for a demon. By such envy, a demon loses everything considered beneficial.
Om Ajnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasma Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Karati Vachalam Pangum Langate Kirim Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Panchakalpatarubhyascha kripa sindubhyaiva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaham. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
I cannot say it is a very interesting verse because then I would claim that others are not. It is one of the topic of this verse is represents one of the greatest, probably the greatest concern in the life of any devotee, namely being offensive, being offensive towards Mahat. And Mahat, as Srila Prabhupada points out in the purport, refers to or a devotee of the Lord or God himself. And to be offensive, disrespectful towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead or his representatives, his devotees, is greatly, greatly dangerous. We could, of course, look at this verse from the point of view of the verse itself, or we could look at it also as it appears in this story. I don't do that anymore, but I remember once I was in disagreement with one devotee who was much senior to me, and I told him, Prabhu, you're offensive to me. and I remember his reaction. He followed the, this is a person who was age of my father, very senior to me, not just physically, but also spiritually. And by the amount of service he's rendered to the movement and Srila Prabhupada, just a towering giant in comparison to me. But somehow or other I felt offended, and I was dumb enough to actually tell him that. And his response was remarkable. He folded his palms and he said, Prabhuji, I'm afraid of an offense. He was very afraid that. He was very honest. He wasn't offensive, of course. But it is perhaps the greatest fear to any devotee. We find, for example, in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, Dhritarashtra, who was never overtly offensive to the Pandavas, I assume you all are familiar with the story, Dhritarashtra was never overtly offensive to the Pandavas, but was covertly offensive to the Pandavas. He had a great fortune that Vidura took great compassion upon him and instructed him into what the goal of life is, because he apparently forgot it, which is, not uncommon for people to forget what the goal of life is. And especially when exposed to opulence and fame and etc., power, people forget this. And Dhritarashtra found himself at the court of living in the house, well, it was a palace, of the people whom he indirectly tried to kill. And after being instructed by Vidura, he actually came to his senses and he abandoned the comforts of the house. And he went to the jungles to seek self-realization. And he was really good at it. He really committed. The nature of his commitment was formidable. But, it was a very powerful lesson, but he could not attain Krishna consciousness. What's interesting. What he attained, we could say only, it's not only, it's hard to call impersonal liberation only, it's a remarkable achievement. Remarkable achievement. But in comparison to the ultimate goal of life is, he missed the point. And the acharyas explained why he was unable to actually attain Krishna consciousness because of his offenses towards the Pandavas. He was covertly offensive to the Pandavas. He allowed his sons to be antagonistic towards the Pandavas. And because of this, this offense blocked his spiritual advancement. From this story, we learn two things. One is clearly the offenses are something very dangerous. And then the other thing is that without the mercy of devotees and without the mercy of Krishna, you can get only so far in Krishna consciousness. So that's rather an important lesson. But let's go back to the topic of this verse. So what we this verse was uttered by Sarvabhauma, right? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Sarvabhauma. When Sarvabhauma heard, how often do you have Chaitanya Charitamrita discussion? Once a week, so long enough to forget what was discussed last time. Okay. It just occurred to me. Okay, then changing the game plan. What's interesting in this chapter, I'm not sure whether the author, Krishnadas Karaj Goswami, did this on purpose or this is just by accident. Doesn't matter, but nevertheless, what we find here is a juxtaposition of two opposites. This chapter begins with a description of devotees who have come to Jagannath Puri from Bengal to be in the divine presence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his presence to engage in serving Lord Jagannath, to engage in Krishna Katha, have kirtans, etc., etc. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu enjoyed the company very much. There's description how Advaita Acharya would come and place Mahaprabhu on a special seat, and then he would worship Mahaprabhu. He would offer him articles of worship. And then Mahaprabhu would, when he would accept that worship, he would accept all the items of worship. And then afterwards, Mahaprabhu, while remaining sitting in this special position, then, with the remaining items, he would worship Advaita Acharya. And then, in the beginning of the chapter, Krishnadas Karaj Goswami says that Mahaprabhu, while worshipping, would recite a mantra, which is, as far as I know, not to be found in the Vedas. It was a joke. They had that kind of a very intimate relationship. I forget the mantra. So he... You are who you are, and I worship you. We don't know who you are, but you are, and we worship you, something like that. Does anyone know? Something like that, yeah. Yaha. Yosi. Yaha. Sa. Ada. Okay, we'll come back to it. Let's finish this presentation. And then they would laugh and have an awesome time. So what you find here, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, not an incarnation of Krishna, but rather Krishna himself. But Krishna himself, who comes as a devotee, and is having this fantastic relationship with his devotees. As a matter of fact, when I was given the task of sorting out, reviving, building up a Brahmacharya ashram in one place, then in consultation with other Brahmacharis in the ashram, we decided to have regular Chaitanya Charitamrita readings so that devotees together could experience this wonderful world of devotee association as found in Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that hopefully that would spill over a little bit of it at least into our ashram and into our dealings. And I'm not sure whether it was that or something else, or maybe all of it together, but the ashram did expand and expanded quite a bit. And then we have description of devotees then leaving. There were some other things, I can't remember all the details. There, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami describes how devotees from Bengal are leaving Jagannath Puri to return to Bengal. They have spent 4 months in Jagannath Puri with Mahaprabhu in each other's association. And Mahaprabhu is described there to, he appeared like he had five mouths. He with such relish glorified devotees and spoke of them in the greatest of affection. What's that devotee was really bad at managing his funds? I forget his name. No? Okay, that's now guessing. No, I don't know. I don't remember. I don't think it was Srivas. Was it? Oh, is it? Okay. Okay. Aditya. Mahaprabhu is taking, there he is, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a sannyasi, and he's having so much affection for this person who's a householder. And he's telling some other devotee, you take care of him. They're about to leave. And Mahaprabhu's just melting in ecstasy. And he tells this other devotee, you please take care of him. He's so bad with money. And he needs money for him and his family. Can you please manage his funds? Full of affection. And then what else was there? Then the Lord remembered Vasudev Datta. So I don't think it's the same person. Because Vasudev Datta was the person who asked Mahaprabhu to liberate all souls in the universe by taking all of their karma and putting all of that karma on his back, so that he would suffer nearly unlimitedly. But no matter, let them be liberated. And this is, as they're leaving, Mahaprabhu's looking at these devotees. Vasudev Datta's leaving. Do you know who Vasudev Datta is? And then he proceeds to glorify. Vasudev Datta is this person who wanted to have me transfer all of the karma of all living beings in the material world on his back. This is our Vasudev Datta. And like this, one devotee after another. Then he remembers his mother. Who's also a great devotee, if we can use the term great at all. These are Mahaprabhu's eternal associates. Then he remembers his mother as a sannyasi, full of affection. He remembers his mother. And he tells devotees to take some Mahaprasadam, Jagannath Mahaprasadam, to take to his mother. And then he says things like, only in madness have I abandoned the love and service of my mother. Only in, I was not quite all right in my mind when I took sannyas. You could say it's a pretty far out thing to say for a sannyasi. But he was full of affection for his mother. And he's sending his, and he says, The only reason why I'm in Jagannath Puri is because in madness I took sannyas, and she told me to, because that's actually what happened. Earlier, prior to that, he asked his mom, what should I do now? I took sannyas, and she said, well, it's too late, you took sannyas, we can't break that. But at least be in Puri, so I will regularly get news from you, as devotees from Bengal typically travel lots to Puri. What else was there in the chapter? Does anyone remember? Because I don't.
Well, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's son-in-law offended.
Oh, no, not just yet. That comes way later. But before, as Mahaprabhu was glorifying devotees, he was... I had to stop you because first this, then the other thing. otherwise, we would finish this class way too early. Jagadananda Pandit was glorified, and I can't remember for what. And I forgot to say earlier, before he was bidding farewell to all the devotees going back to Bengal, Mahaprabhu was, there's a description of Mahaprabhu's, what should we call them, festivals or activities that Mahaprabhu had with his devotees, where they enacted different leelas of the Lord, and he enjoyed himself together with the other devotees. And so this is fantastic time. And then Krishna consciousness continues. Fantastic Krishna consciousness continues. When all the devotees from Bengal are now leaving, after they have left, Sarvabhauma thought, who was the resident of Puri, he thought, this is now amazing opportunity for me. Why is this amazing opportunity for me? Because with all these devotees present, it was hard to serve Mahaprabhu. Like, I had that experience when I traveled with my Guru Maharaj. As long as we were visiting temples that where there were not too many devotees, I had plenty of opportunity to render service. Then we came to nowadays very famous temple, Chaupati. Those devotees were so eager for service. Like, I had to be with Guru Maharaj in the room when he was taking off his cloth so I could have him washed. And then as I came out of his room, I had to guard his cloths not to be by force taken away by other brahmacharis who wanted to wash it. I literally had to fight. And this is without exaggeration. And I made it to my room, and then I closed the door. And then after some time, one brahmachari knocked, and I opened the door, and he pushed me with the door, ran in, stole the clothes, and ran out. Quite a difference. Excuse me, that wasn't Chaupati, it was Pune, but same people. Which was quite a difference from a temple that we was just prior to. We came off the train, and then a few devotees came and took Maharaj and left me with my luggage and Maharaj. And Guru Maharaj's luggage, and left me, they took off. And they forgot about me. And they took off in a car. And only after some time, I guess Guru Maharaj told them, look, there's a brahmachari with me. So they went back and came to get me. It was like that, those couple of days at that temple. And it was a total difference when we came over to this other temple where I couldn't get to serve. So Sarvabhauma thought, this is now amazing opportunity. Now I shall serve Mahaprabhu to my heart's content. And then he approached Mahaprabhu and he asked him, please grant me this wish. I wish to feed you lunch every day for 1 month. And Mahaprabhu was, not a chance. I'm a sannyasi, and this is very much contrary to the sannyasa dharma. I ought to live simply, and I'm not supposed to be begging always from the same person. And Sarvabhauma said, okay, 20 days. And in this way, they negotiated eventually 5 days. And what's interesting, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, we have Sarva Bhauma describing Mahaprabhu, his plan to serve all of the sannyasis. There were 10 sannyasis with Mahaprabhu. And he had a plan how he was going to serve every one of them for that whole month, so that every day he would have a festival at his house. And the festival was that him and his wife would just cook and cook and cook and cook some more. And then serve the devotees, and then afterwards the cleanup and all that. And enjoyed this very much. And so at this point, he invited Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to a newly constructed place. It was a new addition to the house. And Chaitanya Charitamrita describes that there were two doors to this room. One door was from the outside. That was the door for other people to come in. And there was the internal door, the door that led to the kitchen. And so if you were in the kitchen, you could, from the kitchen into this room, bring prasad. And Mahaprabhu entered this room, and when he entered, he saw this huge opulence, of prasadam that Sarva Bhauma and his wife made. There's description that there was how many pounds of rice, but it was a huge pile of rice, and there was so much ghee on it. They poured ghee, that's what they do in India. They poured so much ghee that the ghee was overflowing the banana leaf. And there was about 20 other preparations around, and they're all in these big jugs, earthen pots, placed around. And Mahaprabhu was impressed that, how did you even manage to cook all of this? And Sarva Bhauma said, well, by the mercy of the one who's going to eat it, we also cooked it. Referring to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then Mahaprabhu wouldn't sit on the place where prasadam was offered to Krishna. He says, no, it's a sacred place. I cannot sit there. And Sarva Bhauma told him, well, if you can eat the remnants of the Lord, then you can also sit in his seat. And interestingly enough, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu quoted this verse from the Bhagavatam that says that if it's a statement that by wearing your garlands and eating the remnants of the food you ate, etc., etc., we can conquer the influence of the illusory energy. It's a Shastric statement. So there's some scope for using Krishna's paraphernalia. And so Mahaprabhu sat down. And what's interesting Sarva Bhauma Bhattacharya had a son-in-law. And at this point, Chaitanya Charitamrita takes a super sharp turn. Up until now, it's just the spiritual world. And then at this point, what we have is the introduction of a dark character, Amogha. And Amogha was this person who obviously had a propensity to criticize. And it's an interesting term, propensity to criticize. Because when he entered the room, first of all, Sarva Bhauma knew what his son-in-law was like. And he personally guarded the room so that Amogha wouldn't enter the room. He sort of expected that he might want to enter the room. So he guarded the room with a stick. And while he was serving Mahaprabhu inside the room, Amogha slipped in. And then he saw this huge amount of prasadam. And he said, what is this? This is enough for like 20 people. And this one sannyasi is going to eat it all. And what's interesting here is this term, propensity to criticize. Because as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu later on in the chapter points himself out, what Amogha said was not incorrect. This is very important. What Amogha said was not incorrect. Sannyasi is not supposed to eat for 20 people. and for God's sake, that is to be criticized. But the thing is, that Amogha had the propensity to criticize. And because he had propensity to criticize, he found grounds for criticism. He did not take into consideration a billion other things. The fantastic pastimes, dealings between Mahaprabhu and other devotees, the fact that Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, the fact that what goes on there is the exchange of bhakti, which is way more important than one sannyasi eating a bit too much. That the devotion and the enthusiasm of these devotees, Sarvabhauma and his wife, was unbounded. And it was expressed in this terrible feast. I mean, few times I saw what devotees made to Jayapataka Swami. It was like Maharaj sat on the floor and there was ocean of prasad in front of him. Had Amogha seen that? For God's sake. And people do this kind of stuff because they have propensity to criticize. This is, by the way, the psychologists call this cheap virtue. Cheap virtue, because we have this, you know, innately we want to feel virtuous. To feel virtuous means to feel good, that I'm good, I'm right. And the cheapest way to accomplish that is to criticize someone else. That automatically places you in the fantastic position, meaning that person's immoral and I am moral. That person is not virtuous and I am. And specifically I am because I'm pointing that out. And another interesting mechanism of this cheap virtue phenomena is that every situation, like the situation with Mahaprabhu, is rather a complex one. There's not just one dimension, namely that there is a sannyasi and he's eating. There's so much more. There's another dimension, that's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The other dimension is that that feast was cooked by devotees who were so eager to serve Mahaprabhu and to serve him in ridiculously fantastic ways. and on and on and on. There's so much. So much to consider in this situation. So typically, there's no situation in life which is black and white. But the cheapest thing is to make the situation black and white. Put a label, that's evil or that's good. And then feel good about oneself. I am virtuous. This is one of the aspects of the psychology of a person who has a propensity to criticize. Cheap virtue. That's easy stuff. In other words, you become virtuous without actually being virtuous. If you want to be virtuous, then you take the trouble. You take the trouble to assess the situation deeply, to understand all the aspects of the situation before you cast your judgment. And this is no easy thing to do. Especially if we perceive ourselves, which is often what happens, when we perceive ourselves as sort of a victim or endangered by a certain concept or a certain group of people or a certain phenomena, then we tend to quickly take a machine gun and shoot. That's called cheap virtue. But the great person is the person who can rise above that, rise above one's own fears and low urges, etc., etc. And then assess the situation, even if the other person or persons are acting what may appear to be evil, why they're doing that. Where does that come from? What kind of attitude should I take towards it? Should I merely denounce it? Or should I perhaps understand it, which would be a compassionate thing to do? So what's interesting in this criticizing of Amogha, Amogha's criticizing of Mahaprabhu, was that he saw something which was not in order. But he took only that one thing. He didn't see that one thing in the greater perspective. So what we find in this chapter is this huge contrast. You have the whole of the chapter. All of the chapter is just description of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his devotees having an awesome time. Krishna conscious awesome time. They're so eager to serve each other. They're so eager to serve Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They're so eager to hear and chant. They're so eager to serve, etc., etc. And then you have this amoga. Just where did this guy come from? So by juxtaposing these two, a point, just by that, a point is made. And what's interesting that this mechanism of offense, that when we're offensive, you see, holy name, devotees, scriptures, guru, these are agents of Krishna. And as agents of Krishna, their mission is to deliver the conditioned soul. And the worst thing that the conditioned soul can do is be offensive towards these agents. So by being offensive towards these agents, you're literally canceling your salvation. That's the mechanism of the offense. Like chanting, if you chant inattentively or offensively, for a long period of time, you become an atheist. You literally conclude in this, there's nothing in this chanting. And I'm the proof of it. Because that's the nature of consciousness. When you have a certain experience, you can't go against it. And so, people who have propensity to criticize are people who have, their consciousness has taken that position. They can't help it. Like this amoga, he was so acutely aware of that one, otherwise absolutely, totally insignificant and irrelevant thing, which was otherwise true, namely that there was a sannyasi eating a lot. So this becomes a huge problem in the life of any devotee, to become offensive, disrespectful towards other devotees. And the troubling part is that very often when we're offensive, we think we're right and this ought to be done and told and pointed out. Unaware of many other elements that make up the reality that we're trying to criticize. So that's a huge issue. And so less advanced a devotee is, less pure a devotee is, more this propensity is present. And what should one do? Well, one should hear and chant and associate with devotees. But if you're so offensive, what do you do? Therefore, devotee is described as prayata atma in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that one who offers me leaf or water, you know, we could say otherwise seemingly insignificant things, but if they're offered by prayata atma, by a person who is self-controlled, I accept that. Srila Prabhupada translates prayata atma as a devotee. Devotee also means one who is devoted or one who is disciplined by Krishna or by the spiritual master. So it is of utmost importance to understand that the process of Krishna consciousness does not merely involve, merely, we can just say merely, the chanting Hare Krishna and study of the scripture, etc., serving, but the process also involves overcoming offensive attitude or propensity to fault find. And therefore one ought to be prayata atma, like try to control this. try to become aware of this and try to control this before the offenses go too far. Om Tat Sat. Are there perhaps, there are comments or questions.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, welcome to Lacho.
Thank you.
You are sharing your experience in Pune, so I want to share one that one devotee from there told me. Well, not Pune, but Chaupati, that he went there and I'm not sure if he was visiting or joining a temple, but one morning serving devotees for breakfast prasadam after Bhagavatam class, he just went and he picked up a pot to serve, and then told him, no, he can't do that, that you have to go to the supervisor who supervised serving prasadam and to, you know, seek his permission to do this service. So when he went there, he told a devotee that he would like to serve prasadam. So he said, okay, let me put you on the list. So he pulled out this list.
Waiting list for washing
and
pots.
And he looked. So he went down the list, 90, so he put 91 and he put his name there. He said, what is this for? He said, there are 90 devotees in front of you, so you have to wait on the 91st day to serve breakfast prasadam. So that's really nice enthusiasm. And Maharaj, I have one question. You were talking about Dhritarashtra, that he didn't achieve love of Krishna because of his offensive nature to the devotees, namely the Pandavas. So I just thought about Bhishma Dev, who was somewhere in between, that even though he didn't offend the devotees, he didn't offend the Pandavas, he had love for them, but because of his pledge to serve the other party, then he had to make decisions or acting opposing ways to the Lord's devotees. So what was his position?
That's a very good question. I had a similar question. Once I asked the question, gee, it's a troubling question. I'll say it anyways. If Vasudeva and Devaki knew that Kansa was going to kill all of the kids, why did they keep having children? So one thing, and Savas Prabhu at that time, the president of New Dwarka, our temple in Los Angeles, he offered a possible answer to that, which in many ways made sense, but which is sort of pertinent to this. And I'm not saying that this is the only answer, but it's a pertinent one. You see, great devotees like Narada Muni, for example, they have this, what I guess a hippie would describe as a cosmic consciousness. where the person sees everything, Yomam Pashati Sarvatra Sarvam Chamai. A person sees everything within God and God in everything. And this is not to be imitated by neophytes. So having this cosmic consciousness, the person sees that all this is enacted, all of this ought to be done because Krishna wants it. And then the people just settle, devotees, great devotees, they just settle in their roles. Sometimes devotees are directed in this fashion without them even knowing, as things are arranged by Yogamaya. By the way, is this water or?
Yes.
Oh. It doesn't look clear.
Oh,
okay, I see, okay. Just, I thought there was coconut.
Close.
And my mouth is really dry. Um, So in this way, devotees actually participate, sometimes knowingly, sometimes not knowingly, in Krishna's plan. And so in this way, they're not at fault, they're not offensive, as opposed to Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra is described as offensive. That is the difference. And then also, reality happens on several different platforms, which we call dharmas. And the Shastra, for our benefit at least, very often engages different individuals in the discussion of what is actually dharmic, so that we can actually practice what in the academic world is known as moral reasoning, so that we can morally reason and practice moral reasoning so that our moral reasoning improves, and so that we ourselves can determine what is dharma, what is adharma, or in other words, what is evil and what is good, which goes back to that cheap virtue. You know, the easiest thing is to not morally reason, or to do some poor moral reasoning quick, you know, just take a couple of things into consideration, draw a conclusion, and label people, ideas, objects, etc. Most of people do exactly this. But such people are not advanced at moral reasoning, and I would venture to say they're not spiritually very advanced. So in this way, Bhishma Devi is not, it was not offensive, whereas Dhritarashtra was. Dhritarashtra had a choice and he used it differently. Is that okay? Okay. That Mataji had a hand, and then I wasn't sure, I hope I'm not, then over here, and then yourself. Yes.
Yes, again, regarding Dhritarashtra, could we speculate that if he acknowledged his offense and was repentant, that would have changed his destination?
Oh, good point.
Because he was seemingly just interested in his own liberation, to get out of there. He followed Vidura's suggestion, get out, you gotta, you know.
As far as I understand, the good news is that when we commit an offense, there is a way out of it also. It's not that once you make an offense, then it's forever. But the offenses do have more or less lasting effect. Now, what can we do to alleviate the offense? We're told you can go apologize, you can bow down, offer your sincere apology and service, specifically from the person or to the person to whom you have offended. So I would think that I think we could definitely say that had Dhritarashtra done something like that, he would have been in much better position. Now, how much better position? That's really between him and Krishna, and as they say, devil's in the details. What's the nature of that apology? What's the nature of his offense? As far as I recall in the Bhagavatam, that's only briefly discussed, not into great details. But in terms of principles, yes, if one does apologize and feels repentant, then that's way better.
In the case of Amoga, did he repent, or was it just a case of Lord Chaitanya's causeless mercy?
I didn't want to say all of that on purpose, because some devotees do that. They speak on the verse and then they complete the chapter. So there's no content left for those who are going to lecture afterwards. But one of the points, Amoga Lila, there's Prabhupada's disciple. Prabhupada gave one devotee, some of you may know him, Amoga Lila. Why Amoga Lila? Because this is rather a fantastic pastime. I mean, we stopped at this, the worst of points in the pastime. that whole pastime is a yet another manifestation, just right from the beginning, how dear to Krishna devotees are, and devotion. Bhakti and bhaktas are just immensely dear to Krishna. And he goes totally out of his way to help such devotees. And as the chapter continues, Amoga is going to be saved from his horrible destiny. The very next day, he was fatally diseased. And when Mahaprabhu heard this, he went there immediately to... Amoga didn't approach him, but Mahaprabhu approached Amoga. And then Mahaprabhu sort of cleared the effects of the offense. But Amoga did apologize also when Mahaprabhu approached. He was very sore, I'm the lowest of creatures, etc., etc. And Mahaprabhu told him, you are a brahmana. Heart of a brahmana is this beautiful, fragrant place. I mean, how did you pollute it so bad? With this propensity to criticize. And then, you know, Amoga became a great devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But the one of the major points there is that he specifically got to mercy, not because he apologized, because Mahaprabhu approached him first. So he got to mercy. Why? Because he was merely related to a devotee. And that was also repeated several times in this chapter and throughout the book, that if someone's just related to a devotee, like lives in the devotee's house, I love him. Mahaprabhu says. Yes.
So, relating to the Vasudeva and Devaki still having children.
No, don't take me there. That's a difficult one.
It's just a little bit of foundation for the question. They're doing it as a service to Krishna's Leela, as their role. And Dhritarashtra didn't get that same pardon because he was offensive. So my question is, at what point does it become free will offensive versus Krishna's Leela? Because Dhritarashtra was also playing a very vital part in the whole pastime.
Yeah, good question. The difference is between the type of Maya. Typically, the soul is always under the influence. But soul has the freedom, not only freedom, but with that freedom comes the responsibility to make the right choices. And ultimately, the right choice is, as Srila Prabhupada quoted this, is Mahatmanastu mam partha daivim prakritim asharitaha. Our freedom should be used in such a way that we choose daivim prakritim, divine energy, so that we become under the influence, so that we're influenced or under the influence of Daivi or the divine energy rather than than Krishna's external energy. And so when a person is under the influence of yoga maya, it's all good. When the person is under the influence of maha maya, then it's no good. But again, person comes under the influence of maha maya, but by their own choice.
Is there a way that we can tell if it's Krishna's arrangement or if it's someone choosing a darker path?
Yeah. The huge difficulty is in the fact that we get covered over to different extents. If we're going to use, let's say, Bhagavad Gita language, we get covered by karma. We could just say covered by maya to different extent. I mean, I remember once I just started this Shastradana program, which later on exploded, really grew really big. And I had beat up old temple van, loaded it with books, and it was going off to some part of LA to distribute Prabhupada's books there. Placed these books in libraries, hospitals, coffee shops, medical offices. And the thing died on me. The engine just died, stopped working, and then I just managed to exit the highway, and this beat up vehicle full of holes, rust holes. I mean, it was really looking bad, and it stopped in front of a super shiny building of some kind of insurance company or whatever it was, and there I was trying to do something, calling devotees to to come get me, etc., etc. And then the people started pouring out of this building. It was a stark contrast, you know, finely dressed people and a monk in a beat up van. And then one of them was staring at me and he said, look at you. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy's aggressive. First I felt uneasy that it was staring at me. And he said, look at you. And then he paused and he says, look at me. and then he called himself pathetic. I don't remember the terms, but it was something like that. He really denounced himself, thinking himself to be overly materialistic. And then he said, and then the worst thing is, there's nothing I can do about it. And then he walked away. And I was like, wait, I want to give you a book. Took off. So we could say someone like that is obviously covered to the point where the person can at least occasionally see what's up, but is covered enough to he can't do much about it. You can get covered over so much that neither do you know, neither can you do anything about it. Neither you're aware of your condition, thinking you're fantastic. So then in that case, as Srila Prabhupada, quoting Srila Rupa Goswami, says, the bound, only the unbound can help the bound. Then you require external help if you went that far. And if you haven't gone that far, then depends if you still have some, if there is a hole in the curtain, Maya Javanikachanam, in the Bhagavatam first canto, Kunti Devi. That if there's a hole in the curtain of Maya and you peek through, oh, reality, then you have a chance, something that you can do on your own, maybe initiate some action. But typically, it's ultimately a joint work, you know, between yourself and the spiritual master and the Vaishnavas, etc., like that. And sometimes Maya gives a prod.
No,
absolutely not deterministic. Absolutely not. No. If it was deterministic, then we would bear no responsibility for our acts. We're conditioned and limited, but not deterministic. I think it's prasadam time. Oh, I apologize. No, go ahead. This is the last question. If you, and we could continue discussing, but after we officially close the shop. Yes.
I was just wondering, sometimes when you're with devotees all the time, it's easy to make offenses and not realize that you've been offensive. Mm-hmm. But yet, Krishna still takes that personally because it's a devotee. So how do we get free of the offenses that we don't realize that we've committed, or we don't realize how bad it is?
Mm-hmm. Man, am I getting difficult questions today? Well, first I would say that I didn't send that message out. I didn't want to alert to something which the verse is alerting about, namely that we be very cautious about this, but we need not be so cautious that we become paralyzed by it. Like, oh, I'm entering devotee association. What should I do? I don't think we need to do that. But how to know whether we have been offensive? I guess it would help to be liberal-minded enough to project to other devotees that we're happy to get the feedback, which sometimes tends to invite people who love to give feedback, which is destructive. That's not good. That doesn't help anyone, that kind of destructive criticism. But a criticism from a well-wisher, a balanced person is a good and healthy thing. So if we cultivate that, I guess that'd be one thing we could do. That there is not an air around us, the attitude of resentment towards receiving feedback. But again, be cautious not to invite people who love to do that. And when I say love, like people have that propensity unnecessarily pointing stuff out. Is that okay? Okay. Thank you. I will grant Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki